This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
6 Music.
This is a free download from the BBC. To find out more, go to the 6 Music website.
Hello and welcome to this year's BBC Music John Peel Lecture in Salford, part of the Radio Festival with Seven Digital and with me, Lauren Laverne. The Peel Lecture, of course, takes its inspiration from John Peel, one of the greatest radio broadcasters of all time. Let's just take a moment to remember why.
This is 6 Music.
6 Music.
I like the idea that as you're educating yourself to the present and to the future, you're also re-educating yourself as to your past.
This is the first of a new series of programmes in which you may hear just about anything. We'll also play records by groups that you may not have heard of that we consider worthy of exposure.
John Peel, who would have been 75 this year, was a broadcaster who changed the landscape of British music.
If you can get a lot of people listening to Captain Beefheart, whether they listen to him because it's a cult thing or because they really listen, doesn't really matter that much. Chances are they'll get into it properly eventually anyway. You know, it's worth all the ludicrous nonsense you have to go through to do it.
While this has been playing, I have to say, we've been having a bit of a debate here in the studio about whether it should be played at 45 or 33 and a third. When I was listening to it at home, 45 sounded right, but it sounds a bit mad now.
When we'd first played reggae, people had written in and said, come on, old fella, pull yourself together, as they do now with hip-hop.
That's better, actually, that's to be said.
The very fact that we are always going to be linked with John Peel, it's just it's such a compliment to us. I don't think we could ever say enough words of thanks to him.
Hello and welcome back to Glastonbury, where it is not at the moment raining, which is quite exciting in itself.
I can't really describe what it is that I find attractive about the things that I do find attractive. I really don't know what it is I don't like about Bruce Springsteen. It just doesn't ring true to me.
More of the same unpleasant and disorientating racket on tomorrow night's programme. Until then, from me, John Peel, good night and good riddance.
Marking the 10th anniversary of his death, BBC Music presents the John Peel Lecture. Of course, the Peel Lecture celebrates John and keeps his spirit alive. And we do this by asking another standout opinionated individual to share their ideas about the big debates in music and to shape what we're thinking and talking about, just as John would have if he was still here today. John was a figure who perpetually challenged the status quo and a man with a love of teenage kicks. So who better to deliver this year's lecture than an icon whose music has soundtracked teen rebellion for over 40 years? One time forgotten boy, now the godfather of punk, and BBC Six Music presenter, Iggy Pop.
Come on now!
I didn't really want to go to school and sign up for a lifetime of drudgery. Music gave me hope to go on another path in life.
When Iggy and the Stooges crashed onto the stage in 1967, no one had seen or heard anything quite like them before. Don Letts was a DJ at London's foremost punk club in 1977.
When I first heard Iggy's stuff down at the Roxy, it was definitely fresh. I'd never heard anything like that. It was coming from this totally other place. We're talking dark and threatening.
Iggy was a major inspiration to Pretenders vocalist Chrissy Hynde.
It's electrifying. I think he's, you know, he ranks with the greatest performers of all time. I would put him up there with James Brown, and there aren't many that I would put in his category. He's my number one.
I feel all right. I feel all right.
The boy from a trailer park in Ypsilanti, Michigan, quickly earned a reputation as the wildest man in rock and the godfather of punk.
We'd heard the term punk applied to us, kind of meant to be a dismissal or an insult, like some skinny kids who can't, you know, who don't count. And so we count.
The Stooges' raw industrial sound combined with Iggy's anarchic stage presence became the blueprint for alternative rock bands, from the Sex Pistols to Nirvana and the White Stripes. One early admirer was David Bowie, who produced Iggy's first solo albums.
Well, what a great, wonderful, funny, pithy, great writer he is. It is really odd. Ig's been responsible for so much that's happened, especially on the punk side of rock, that he's never really had that kind of mass acceptance.
But recognition for Iggy's talent has continued to grow. He's collaborated with a broad range of musicians. He carved out an acting career in films such as John Waters' Crybaby.
Wowie! You caught me in my birthday suit! Butt naked!
His music has also featured on movie soundtracks, including Trainspotting in 1996, which brought him to a whole new generation of fans.
That song was bubbling. So people smelled something there, and the song sounded so good, sooner or later, it was gonna break.
With 5 decades in the business, having embraced all the excesses of rock and roll, Iggy is a man still in rude health with no intention of growing old quietly. Noel Fielding is another Iggy devotee.
Live is incredible. The transference of energy is unbelievable. You can feel it. He's a great performer. I love it, 'cause it's quite dangerous, isn't it?
After reuniting with the Stooges and playing an unforgettable Glastonbury set in 2007, Iggy and the band were finally inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2010. And now, in his latest role as presenter for Six Music, he's introducing listeners to his own musical passions.
BBC Radio 6 Music. Iggy Pop's Rocking Rebels.
Hey, that was Rumble by the late, great Link Wray. What I love about Six Music is that they've given me the chance with an open book to rediscover for myself and to play music that really rings my bell. Every song or piece of music I like seems to trigger later a memory of where I was and what I was doing when I liked it.
The mainstream was never what it was about. It was never about being the biggest band. It was never about being a household name. He always stayed outside the law.
Well, come on!
And for real rock fans, that's what really appeals to us about rock and roll.
Ladies and gentlemen, the BBC Music John Peel Lecture 2014, sharing his thoughts on free music in a capitalist society, the American Caesar himself, Mr. Iggy Pop.
Hi. Can you hear me? All right, I'm Iggy Pop. I've held a steady job at BBC Six Music now for almost a year, which is a long time in my game. I always hated radio and the jerks who pushed that shit music into my tender mind, with rare exceptions. When I was a boy, I used to sit for hours suffering through the entire U.S. radio top 40, waiting for that one song by the Beatles and the other one by the Kinks. Had there been anything like John Peel available in my Midwestern town, I would have been thrilled. So it's an honor to be here. I understand that. I appreciate it. Some months ago, when the idea of this talk came up, I thought it might be okay to talk about free music in a capitalist society. So that's what I'm going to try to talk about. A society in which the capitalist system dominates all the others and seeks their destruction when they get in its way. Since then, the shit has really hit the fan on that subject, thanks to U2 and Apple. I worked half of my life for free. I didn't really think about that one way or the other until the masters of the record industry kept complaining that I wasn't making them any money. To tell you the truth, when it comes to art, money is an unimportant detail. It just happens to be a huge unimportant detail. to all of us. But a good LP is a being. It is not a product. It has a life force, a personality, and a history just like you and me. It can be your friend. You try explaining that to a weasel. As I learned when I hit 30 plus and realized I was penniless and almost unable to get my music released, music had become an industrial art. And it was the people who excelled at the industry who got to make the art. I had to sell most of my future rights to keep making records and keep going. And now, thanks to digital advances, we have a very large industry which is laughably, maybe, almost entirely pirate. So nobody can collect shit. Well, it was to be expected. Everybody made a lot of money reselling all of recorded musical history in CD form back in the 90s. But now the cat is out of the bag. And the new electronic devices, which estrange people from their morals, also make it easier to steal music than to pay for it. So there's going to be a correction. When I started the Stooges, we were organized as a group of utopian communists. All the money was held communally, and we lived together while we shared the pursuit of a radical ideal. We shared all songwriting, publishing, and royalty credits equally. Didn't matter who wrote it. Because we'd seen it on the back of a Doors album and thought it was cool. At least I did. Yeah, I thought songwriting was about the glory. I didn't know you'd get paid for it. We practiced a total immersion to try to forge a new approach, which would be something of our own. Something of lasting value. Something that was going to be revealed and created. It was not yet known. We are now in the age of the schemer. And the plan is always big, big, big. But it's the nature of the technology created in the service of the various schemes that the pond, while wide, is very shallow. Nobody cares about anything too deeply except money. Running out of it, getting it. I never sincerely wanted to be rich. There's a, in the U.S., we have this guy, do you sincerely want to be rich? You can do it. I didn't sincerely want to be rich. I never sincerely felt like making anybody else that way. That made me kind of a wild card in the 60s and 70s. I got into the game because it felt good to play, and it felt like being free. I'm still hearing today about how my early works with the Stooges were flops. It was a flop, but they're still in print, and they sell. 45 years later, they sell. Okay, it took 20 or 25 years for the first royalties to roll in. So sue me. Some of us who couldn't get anywhere for years kept beating our heads against the same wall to no avail. No one did that better than my friends the Ramones. They kept putting out album after album, frustrated that they weren't getting the hit. They even tried Phil Spector and his handgun. After the first couple of records, which made a big impact, they couldn't sustain the quality. But I noticed that every album had at least one great song, and I thought, wow, if these guys would just stop, give it a rest, society would for sure catch up to them. And that's what's happening now, but they're not around to enjoy it. I used to run into Johnny in a little rehearsal joint in New York, and he'd be in a big room all alone with a Marshall stack. Just going, dum, 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 all by himself. I asked him why. And he said, If he didn't practice doing that exactly the way he did it live, he'd lose it. He was devoted and obsessive. So are Joey and Dee Dee. I like that. Johnny asked me one day, Iggy,
don't you hate Offspring and the way they're so popular with that crap they play? That should be us. They stole it from us. I told him, look, some guys are born and raised to be the captain of the football team. And some guys are just going to be James Dean and rebel without a cause. And that's the way it is. Not everybody is meant to be big. And not everything big is any good. I only ever wanted the money because it was symbolic of love. And the best thing I ever did was to make a lifetime commitment to continue playing music no matter what, which is what I resolved to do at the age of 18. If you are who you are, that is really hard to steal. And it can lead you in all sorts of useful directions when the road ahead of you is blocked. And it will get blocked. Now I'm older, and I need all the dough I can get. So I, too, am concerned about losing those lovely royalties now that they've finally arrived in the maze of the internet. But I'm also diversifying my income because a stream will dry up. I'm not here to complain about that. I'm here to survive it. When I was starting out as a full-time musician, I was walking down the street one bright afternoon in the seedier part of my Midwestern college town. I passed a dive bar, and from it emerged a portly, balding, pallid, middle-aged musician in a white tux with a drink in one hand and a guitar in the other. He was blinking in the daylight. I had a strong intuition that this was a fate to be avoided. He seemed cut off from society and resigned to an oblivious obscurity, a barfly, an accessory to booze. So how do you engage society as an artist and get them to pay you? Well, that's a matter of art and endurance. To start with, I cannot stress enough the importance of study. I was lucky to work in a discount record store in Ann Arbor, Michigan as a stock boy, where I was exposed to a little bit of every form of music imaginable on record at the time. I listened to it all, whether I liked it or not. Be curious. And I played in my high school orchestra, and I learned the joy of the warm, organic instruments working together in the service of a classical piece. That sticks with you forever. If anyone out there can get a chance to put an instrument and some knowledge in some kid's hands, you've done a great, great thing. Comparative information is a key to freedom. I found other people who are smarter than me to teach me. My first pro band was a blues band called the Prime Movers, and the leader, Michael Erlewine, was a very bright hippie beatnik with a beautifully organized record collection in library form of the blues. I'd never really heard the blues. That part of our American heritage was kept off the major media. It was system up, people down. No Big Bill Brunzi on BBC for us. Boy, I wish. No money in it. But everything I learned from Michael's beautiful library became the building blocks for anything good I've done since. But guys like this are priceless. If you find one, follow him or her. Get the knowledge. Once in secondary school in the 60s, some class clowns dressed up the tallest guy in school in a trench coat, shades, and a fedora and rushed him into a school dance with great hubbub. proclaiming, Del Shannon is here! Del Shannon is here! And until they got to the stage, we all believed them because nobody knew what Del Shannon looked like. He was just a voice on some great records. He had no social ID. By the early 60s, that had really changed with the invasion of the Beatles and the Stones. This time, TV was added to the mix, and print media, too. So you knew who they were, or so you thought, anyway. I'm mentioning this because the best way to survive the death or change of an industry is to transcend its form. You're better off with an identity of your own, or maybe a few of them, something special. It is my own personal view, having lived through it, that in America, the Beatles replaced our assassinated President Kennedy, who represented our hopes for a certain kind of society. Didn't get there. And the Stones replaced our assassinated folk music, which our own leaders suppressed for cultural, racial, and financial reasons. It wasn't okay with everybody to be Kennedy or Muddy Waters, but those messages could be accepted if they came through white entertainers from the parent culture. That's why they're still around. Years later, I had the impression that Apple, the corporation, had successfully co-opted the good feelings that the average American felt about the culture of the Beatles by kind of stealing the name of their company. So I bought a little stock. Good move. 1992. Woo! But look, everybody is subject to the ripoff and has to change affiliations from time to time. Even Superman and Barbie were German before America tempted them to come over. Tough luck, Nietzsche. So who owns what anyway? Or as Bob Dylan said, the relationships of ownership. That's Gates of Eden. Nobody knows for long, especially these days. Apparently, when BBC Radio was founded, the record companies in the UK would not allow the BBC to play their master recordings because they thought no one would buy them for their personal use if they could hear them free on the radio. So they were really confused about what they had. They didn't get it. And how people feel about music, because it's a feel thing and it resists logic. It's not binary code. Later, when CDs came in, the retail merchants in America all panicked because they were just too damn tiny and they thought, Americans want something that looks big, like a vinyl record. Well, they had a point, but their solution was a kind of Frankenstein. They called it the long box. It didn't fool anybody because half of it was empty. It's a little CD in the bottom of the empty cardboard. You'd open it up and it was empty. Now we have people in the Sahara using GPS to bury huge wads of ransom euros under sand dunes for safekeeping. The GPS was created for military spying from the high ground, not radical banking. So any sophisticated system, along with the bounty it brings, is subject to primitive hijacking. I want to talk about a type of entrepreneur who functions as a kind of popular music patron of the arts. It's good to know a patron. I call him El Padron because his relationship to the artist is essentially feudal, though benign. he or she, la padrona, if you will, is someone, usually the product of successful, enlightened parents who owns a record company, but has had benefit of a very good education and can see a bigger picture than a petty business person. If they like an artist's style and it suits them, they'll support you even if you're not a big money spinner. And I can tell you, some of these powerful guys get so bored that if you're fun in the office, you'll go places. Their ancestors, the old-time record crooks, just made it their business to make great, great records, but also to rip off the artist 100%. Copyright, publishing, royalty splits, agency fees, you name it. If anyone complained, the line was, pay you, we worship you. God bless Bo Diddley. By the time I came along, there was a new brand of Padron. People like this are still around, and some of them can help you. One was named Jack Holtzman. Jack had a beautiful label called Elektra Records. They put out Judy Collins, Tim Buckley, The Doors, and Love. He'd started working in his family record store like Brian Epstein. He dressed mod and he treated us very gently. He was a civilized man. He obviously loved the arts. But what he really wanted to do was build his business. And he did. He had his own concerns and style, and you had to serve them. And of course, when he sold out, as all indies do, you were stranded culturally in the hands of a cold, clumsy conglomerate. But he put us in the right studios, with the right producers, and he tried to get us seen in the right venues, and it really helped. This is a good example of the industry. Another good guy I met is Sir Richard Branson. I ended up serving my full term at Virgin Records, having been removed from every other label. And he created a superior culture there. People were happier and nicer than the weasels at some other places. The first time he tried to sign me, it didn't work out, because I had my sights set on A&M, a company I thought would help make me respectable. After all, they had Sting. Richard was secretly starting his own company at the time in the U.S., and he phoned me in my tiny flat with no furniture. He said he'd give me a longer-term deal with more dough than the other guys, and he was very, very polite and soft-spoken. But I had just smoked a joint that day. And I couldn't make a decision. So I went with the other guys who soon got sick of me. Virgin picked me up again later on the rebound and on the cheap. Damn, my own fault. Another kind of indie legend who is slightly more contemporary is Long Gone John of the label Sympathy for the Record Industry. Good name. John is kind of famous with some artists for his disinterest in paying royalties. He has a very interesting music-themed folk art collection. It's visible online, which includes My Leather Jacket. I wish he'd give it back. There are lots of indie people with a gift for organization who just kind of collect freaks and throw them up at the wall to see who sticks. You got to watch them. When you go a step down creatively from the padrones, who are actually entrepreneurs, you get to the executives. You don't want to know these guys. They usually came over from legal or accounting. They have proteges, usually called A&R men, to do their dirty work. You can become a favorite with them if your fame or image might reflect limelight on their career. They tend to have no personalities to speak of, which is their great strength. strangely, they're never really thinking about the good of their parent company as much as old number one. Avoid them. If you're an artiste, they will make you feel sick or suicidal. The only good thing the conglomerate can do for you, and they've done it recently for me, is make you really, really ubiquitous. They do that well. But when the company is your banker, then you are basically going to be the Beverly Hillbillies. So it's best not to take their money, especially when you're young. These are very tough people, and they can hurt you. So who are the good guys, they asked me when they read this thing at BBC Six Music. Well, there are lots of them. In fact, today there are more than ever, and they are just about all indies. But first, I want to mention Peter Gabriel and WOMAD for everything they've done for what seems like forever to help the greatest musicians in the world, the so-called world musicians, to gain a foothold and make a living in the modern, screwed-up, cash-and-carry world. Traditional music was never a for-profit enterprise. All the best forms were developed as a kind of your job in the community. You know, it was pretty good. Yeah, I'm a musician. I'm going to skip, like, doing the dishes or taking the trash out. It was like that more. And it's not surprising that all the greatest singers and players come from parts of the world where everybody is broke and the old ways are getting paved over. So it's crucial for everyone that these treasures not be lost. There are other people of means and intelligence who help others in this way, like Philip Glass through Tibet House, David Byrne with Luwaka Bop, Damon Albarn through Honest John Records. Shout out to Hypnotic Brass Ensemble. Almost all the best music is coming out on indies today, like XL, Matador, Burger, Anti, Epitaph, Mute, Rough Trade, 4AD, Sub Pop, etc., etc. But now YouTube's trying to put the squeeze on these people, because it's just easier for a power nerd to negotiate with a couple big labels who own the kind of music that people listen to when they're really not that into music, which, of course, is most people. So they've got the numbers. But indies kind of have the guns. I've noticed that indies are showing strength at some of the established streaming services like Spotify and Rhapsody. People are choosing that music. And it's also great that some people are starting their own outlets like Pledge Music, Bandcamp, Drip, etc., etc. As the commercial trade swings more into general showbiz, the indies will be the only place to go for new talent outside the Mickey Mouse Club. And so I think they were right to band together and sign the Fair Digital Deals Declaration. There are just so many ways to screw an artist that it's unbelievable. In the old vinyl days, they would deduct 10% breakage fees for records supposedly broken in shipping, whether that happened or not. And now they have unattributed digital revenue, whatever that means. It means money for some guy's triple bypass. I actually think that what Tom York has done with BitTorrent is very good. I was going to say here, sure, the guy is a pirate at BitTorrent, but I was warned legally. So I'll say, sure, the guy at BitTorrent is a pirate's friend. But all pirates want to go legit, just like I wanted to be respectable. It's normal. After a while, if people feel like you're a crook, it's too hard to do business. So it's good in this case that Tom York is encouraging a positive change. The music's good. It's being offered at a low price. direct to people who care. I want to try to define what I'm talking about when I say free. For me, in the arts or in the media, there are two kinds of free. One kind of free is when the process is something that in which people, you just feel free. You feel a sense of possibility. You feel a lack of constraint. This leads to very, very powerful, energetic, and kind of sometimes loony situations. Vice Media is an interesting case of this because they started as a free handout using public funds. And they had open, freewheeling minds. Originally, the free handout was called Voice. And these kids, yeah, just get rid of the O, it'd be Vice, yeah, okay. By taking an immersive approach with no particular preconceptions to their reporting, they've become a huge success, also through corporate advertising, at attracting big, big money investment. Hundreds of millions of dollars now pumped in Fox Media and a couple others bigger than that in the U.S. And they get it because they attract lots of little boy eyeballs. So they brought us Dennis Rodman in North Korea, which is kind of a travesty, but kind of spunky. It's interesting that capital investment, for all its posturing, never really leads. It always follows. They follow the action. So if it's money you're after, be yourself in a consistent way, and you might get it. You'll at least end up getting what you're worth and feel better. Just follow your nose. The second kind of freedom to me that is important in the media and arts is just the idea of giving freely. When you feel or sense that someone is giving you something, not necessarily with hope of profit, but out of maybe self-respect, Christian charity, whatever it is. That has a very powerful energy. The Guardian, in my understanding, was founded by an endowment by a successful man with a social conscience who wanted to help create a voice for what I would call the little guy. So they have a kind of moral mission or imperative. It's given them the latitude to try to be interesting, thoughtful, and helpful. And they bring Edward Snowden to the world stage, something that was not pleasant for a lot of people to hear about, but maybe you need to know. These two approaches couldn't be more different. To justify their new mega bucks, Vice will have to expand and expand in capital terms. Presumably, they'll have to titillate a dumb but energetic audience. Of course, all capitalist expansions are subject to the Big Bang balloon bust. Poof! And you're gone. As for The Guardian, I would imagine that the task involves gaining the trust and support of a more discerning, less definable reader without spending the principal. There's usually antipathy between cultural poles, but these two actually have a lot in common in terms of the energy and nuisance to power that they're willing to generate. I wish red and blue could come together somehow. Sometimes I'd rather read than listen to music. One of my favorite odd books is Bootleg, The Secret History of the Other Recording Industry by Clinton Halen. I bought the book in the 90s because a couple of my bootlegs were mentioned. I loved my bootlegs. They did a lot for me. I never really thought about the dough much. I liked the titles like Suck on This, Stowaway, DOA, or Metallic KO. The packaging was always way more creative and edgy than most of my official stuff. So I just liked being seen and heard like anybody else. These bootleggers were creative. Here are two quotes from the Dust Jacket by veteran industry stalwarts on the subject of bootlegs in 1994. "Bootleg is the thoroughly researched and highly entertaining tale of those colorful brigands, hapless amateurs, and true believers who have done wonders for my record collection. Rock and roll doesn't get more underground than this." That was David Frick, the music editor of Rolling Stone magazine. I think that bootlegs keep the flame of the music alive by keeping it out of not only the industry's conception of the artist, but also the artist's conception of the artist. That was Lenny Kaye from the Patti Smith Group, musician and critic, and my friend. Wow, sounds vital and heroic. I wonder what these guys feel about all this now, and because things have changed, haven't they? We're now talking about Mega Upload, Kim.com, big money, political power, and varying definitions of theft that are legally way over my head. But I know a con man when I see one. I want to include a rant from an early bootlegger in this discussion because it's so passionate and I just think it's funny. This is Lou Cohan. "If anybody thinks that if I have purchased every single Rolling Stones album in existence and I have bought all the Rolling Stones albums that have been released in England, France, Japan, Italy, and Brazil, that if I have an extra $100 in my pocket, instead of buying a Rolling Stones bootleg, I am going to buy a John Denver album or a Sinead O'Connor album, they are retarded." So the guy is trying to say, don't try to force me. And don't steal my choice. And the people who don't want the free U2 download are trying to say, don't try to force me. And they've got a point. Part of the process when you buy something from an artist, it's a kind of anointing. You're giving that person love. It's your choice to give or withhold. You're giving a lot of yourself besides the money. But in this particular case, without the convention, maybe some people felt that they were robbed of that chance. And they've got a point. It's not the only point. These are not bad guys. But now, everybody is a bootlegger and not so cute as before. And there are people out there just stealing stuff and saying, don't try to force me to pay. And that act of thieving will become a habit. And that's bad for everything. So we are exchanging the corporate ripoff for the public one, aided by power nerds, kind of computer Putins. They just want to get rich and powerful. Now the biggest bands are charging insane ticket prices or giving away music before it can flop in an effort to stay huge. And there's something in this huge thing that kind of sucks. Which brings us to punk. The most punk thing I ever saw in my life was Malcolm McLaren's cardboard box full of dirty old winkle pickers. It was the first thing I saw walking in the door of Let It Rock in 1972, which was his shop at World's End on the King's Road. It was a huge, ugly cardboard bin full of mismatched, unpolished, dried-out, used Winkelfickers without laces at some crazy price, like maybe £5 each. Another 200 yards up the street was Granny Takes a Trip, where they sold proper rock star clothes like scarves, velvet jackets, and snakeskin platform boy boots. Malcolm's obviously worthless box of shit was like a firebomb against the status quo, because it was saying that these violent shoes have the right idea and they are worth more than your fashion, which serves a false value. This is right out of the French Enlightenment. So is the thieving that big a deal? Ethically, yes, and it destroys people because it's a bad road you take. But I don't think that's the biggest problem for the music biz. I think people are just a little bit bored and more than a little bit broke. No money. Especially simple working people who have been totally left out, screwed, and abandoned. If I had to depend on what I actually get from sales, I'd be tending bar between sets. I mean, honestly, it's become a patronage system. There are a lot of corps involved, and I don't fault any of them. But it's not as much fun as playing at the Music Machine in Camden Town in 1977. There is a general atmosphere of resentment, pressure, kind of strange, perpetual war dripping on all the time. And I think that prosecuting some college kid because she or he shared a file is a lot like sending somebody to Australia a couple hundred years ago for poaching his lordship's rabbit. That's how it must seem to poor people who just want to watch a crappy movie for free after they've been working themselves to death all day at Tesco or whatever, you know? If I want to make music at this point in my life, I'd rather do what I want. Do it for free, which I do, or cheap, if I can afford to, and I can, and fund through alternative means like a film budget or a fashion website, both of which I've done. Those seem to be turning out better for me than the official rock and roll company albums I struggle through. Sorry. If I want to make money, well, how about selling car insurance? At least I'm honest. It's an ad, and that's all it is. Every free media platform I've ever known has been a front for advertising or propaganda or both, and it always colors the content. In other words, you hear crap on the commercial radio. The licensing of music by films, corps, and TV has become a flood because these people know they're not a hell of a lot of fun, so they throw in some music that is. I'm all for that because that's the way the door opened for me. I got heard on TV before radio would take a chance. But then I was okay. Good. And others, too. I notice there are a lot of people, younger or younger, getting their exposure that way. But it's a personal choice. I think it's an aesthetic one, not an ethical one. Now, with the internet, it's a good thing that people can choose to hear stuff and investigate it in their own way. If they want to see me jump around the Manchester Apollo with a horsetail, instead of trying to be a proper rock star, they can look good. Personally, I don't worry too much about how much I get paid for any given thing, because I never expected much in the first place, and the whole industry has become bloated in its expectations. Look, Howlin' Wolf would work for a sandwich. This whole thing started in honky-tonk bars. It's more important to do something important or just make people feel something and then just trust in God. If you're an entertainer, your God is the public. They'll take care of you somehow. I want them to hear my music any old which way, period. There is an unseen hand that turns the pages of existence in ways no one can predict. But while you're waiting for God to show up, try to find a good entertainment lawyer. It's good to remember that this is a dream job. Whether you're performing or working in broadcasting or writing or the biz. So dream. Dream. Be generous. Don't be stingy. Please. I can't help but note that it always seems to be the pursuit of the money that coincides with the great art, but not its arrival, because it's just kind of a death agent. It kills everything that fails to reflect its own image. So your home turns into money, your friends turn into money, your music turns into money. No fun. Binary code. 0101. But what you got to do, you got to do. Life is a hurly-burly. So I would say try hard to diversify your skills and your interests. Stay away from drugs. And talent judges. Get organized. Big or little, that helps a lot. I'd like you to do better than I did. Keep your dreams out of the stinky business or you'll go crazy, and the money won't help you. Be careful to maintain a spiritual exit. Don't live by this game, because it's not worth dying for. Hang on to your hopes. You know what those are. They're private. Because that's who you really are. And if you can hang around long enough, you should get paid. It's the ending that counts, and the best things in life really are free. There, I'm done.
Thank you. Fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Come today. Yeah.
Wonderful lecture. Thank you so much, Iggy Pop, ladies and gentlemen. Wasn't that great?
Thank you.
Iggy, I believe that was the first lecture you've ever given, right?
First, yeah, the first real deal.
How was it for you?
It was wonderful. It was, you know, different. It took me back about 40 years.
Yeah.
I felt like a kid trying to listen. You know, I mean, what I have to say, it's just what I have to say. It's no better than what you or you, and it's just what I had to say, and that's it.
Why did you say yes when you were asked to give the lecture this year?
Well, look, I've been working all year spelling for Jarvis on Six Music, and I'm doing it in Miami. And when they asked, I just thought it would be rude not to show face. And there was a little line item toward the end of the page. The proposal said,
"A John Peel lecture."
You know, so I, what is this lecture? You know, and I, someone close to me said, "Oh well, it'll probably just you just talk with a couple notes for 5 or 10 minutes, then do a Q&A." You know, and then suddenly I sat down for a meeting and. With these are very skilled producers there, and I was tough producer named Adam O'Mahon said no, we need a half hour written out, you know, so you know that was the task. The way I did it, the difficult part was, I'm sure you've all gone through this. When you're asked to articulate, it was stopping my own mind. So I had pages and pages from legal pads, you know, a big mishmash with notes that looked like someone in a museum of brute art or somebody in a mental hospital. Little, you know, this and that, and what about the fact that Aerotropolis by John Cassata says we'll soon be abandoning all old-style cities and we'll all live next to airports. And what about the, cheaper goods and that are... It just got to be too much, and I was suffering. I really was. So the way I did it was I always liked Gibbon. When he did The Decline and Fall, he declaimed it. Mm-hmm. So I've got a PA named Spencer, a nice college boy in the U.S., and we sat in the kitchen, and I just started declaiming to him, and it ran about, it would have run nearly an hour. I got hung up on Shakespeare, Who Paid Shakespeare. It's fascinating because he was around when the beginning of publishing rights came in. And the big issue then was it was the crown versus seditionaries. Like, you can't say that, you know. But other people were seeing the financial possibilities for the first time. So Ben Jonson was approached about publishing his plays, and he authorized a publisher and began to collect. Shakespeare wouldn't do it. And I couldn't find out why, whether it was just, that's not cool, just give me the money from the gig, you know, or whatever, or what he felt, I don't know. But he was heavily bootlegged as a result, and a lot of the versions, they'd have some little guy, instead of a tape recorder, he'd have, you know, be scrawling notes, and they'd get it wrong. Mm. I just thought it was fascinating. That went on for pages that I could picture everyone you know, I mean, it's, I don't want to put people through too much. I went to a semester of college, and I could not hack the lectures. So
was it anthropology you studied?
Yeah, the anth was a fun, and there was Asian studies was a good one. But in the lectures, a lot of the profs, they sort of act like, you are in the presence of God or Satan, you know, take your, and I'm just, boy, if you don't get it, just, you know, so, I don't know.
I'm guessing that a lifetime in the music business has been quite a good informal study of anthropology anyway.
Well, Anth 101 is a lot like going to a club. Same thing.
Iggy, there's a couple of things I wanted to pick up on while we have you. When your description of the music industry as a pond that is wide but shallow. It reminded me of Hunter Thompson, that Hunter Thompson quote about the money trench.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
I wondered whether you think that there are more crooks in the music business than in other businesses.
No, and actually I was speaking about just, it's all one system now. It really doesn't matter if it's like little baby booties or CDs. I had a, you know, there was a professor, somebody here would know, it wasn't Harold Bloom. It was another one in the 80s, a right winger, in the U.S. who was sure that the world was going to come to an end because he used the image of a boy listening to Michael Jackson on a Sony Walkman. And he said, here this person is, you know, being enabled through billions of years of evolution and then many thousands of years of science and humanities that came before it, learning, math and everything, all in the service of listening to, you know, and, you know, that kid should be learning Latin. And because of this, the society was going to collapse soon. And I thought, you know, I remembered that from my reading, and I thought, well, if he couldn't have foreseen that, now you don't even need the content. People are more fascinated with the device. You know, I'm sure somebody here has read Neuromancer, which was a great novel in the 90s, and the protagonist has a, you know, he's got a plug just stuck right in his neck. You know, he's quasi. And so to me, it's just nobody gets a chance to care much about anything in as deep a way. And that is strictly a subjective impression. Maybe I'm just a tired old git. That's possible. But, you know, I do notice... when I grew up, there was a cornfield on the left, there was woods to the right, there were beans behind, little two-lane blacktops, this sort of thing. And I've seen in 50 years, the last, I went home once, about 10 years ago, and I saw in 50 years just the encroachment of pavement itself. That's why I mentioned it, talking. I think pavement and quadrilineal street plans are doing a lot in to make kids nuts. And you know, especially when you have to live in public housing and, you know, it's tick, 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 you know. Yeah. And, you know, but honestly, you know, there are guys in the city that go nuts too, because it's the same. After a while, you can't really escape. It's all the same, you know. So that's something I felt. I'm sorry for putting you through this, mate.
Quadrilineal street structure is definitely not punk. I'm feeling you there. In the lecture, you also said, if you are who you are, then that is really hard to steal.
Yeah.
And I know that you've kind of joked in the past about the fact that you, as a kid, had to kind of come to terms with the fact that you were never going to be exactly like your blues heroes that you'd grown up listening to. I think you said you kind of had a Steve Martin in the Jerk moment of realization.
That's true. Yeah, I just, okay, I would have been very happy to skip from being 20 years old to just being a really cool 50-year-old black guy with a, you know, could really, really lay it down you know, hang around a certain crowd. But that wasn't going to happen for me, so...
How would you describe the identity that did come together then, that creative identity that you found?
Well, I thought I knew a couple of... I knew I didn't have a lot of highly developed skills, but I knew my way around a beat, and I knew my way around different forms of music that hadn't been mined yet, and I thought I could write prose and poetry. So I tried to find some people, some delinquents, because respectable people were not going to follow my ideas. They weren't going to... I was just going to get shut up and poo-pooed. So I found... three inarticulate, disconnected kids, and they happened to be beautiful kids with a secret wit. Like a lot of beautiful kids that don't do well, they have their own little secret world, a secret wit. And I caught a whiff of that, and I thought, well, they could be my band, and we could do, in essence, suburban kid blues or kid blues. That was my idea.
Okay.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we need to say goodbye to our wonderful radio friends. So we'd better say goodbye to everybody listening to us on Six Music. Don't forget that you can also watch a programme that's going out 8 p.m. on Sunday on BBC4. And of course, as always, you can listen to Iggy's very own weekly programme on BBC Six Music at 4 o'clock on Sundays too. So thank you very much, everybody listening, for joining us. I wish you all a good night from the Radio Academy here in Salford. And I now pass you back to Mark Riley on BBC Six Music, who I know is celebrating all things Iggy and the spirit of John Peel. Thank you.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
Thanks for listening to this free download from the BBC. For more 6 Music downloads, like The Joy of 6, go to the 6 Music website.